Welcome to CUTV News Radio, where our hosts Doug Llewellyn and Jim Masters talk to today's top thinkers from all around the world to bring you information, inspiration, and thought-provoking ideas that you can put to use in your personal or professional life right now. Covering a broad range of topics, we dig deep to discover what makes today's top thinkers tick. CUTV News Radio, it's the show where ideas matter. And now, here's today's host, Doug Llewellyn.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back. Nice to have you here with us on CUTV News Radio today. We're going to be focusing on law today with a really highly experienced lawyer, and I think you're going to find this pretty fascinating. You know, when somebody gets injured on the job, obviously there are a lot of questions as to whether or not an actual accident actually happened, or whether that person was in the scope of their employment of the type of the accident, time of the accident. Those are just two questions. There are myriads of questions that have to be considered when somebody is injured on the job, and obviously that's when whoever it is injured really needs the help of an experienced lawyer. We're going to be talking to someone who is just exactly that. He's a highly experienced lawyer. His name is Joseph Sinsali. He's the co-founder of the Chase Sinsali Law Group, which is headquartered in Wantagh on New York's Long Island. And by the way, he's on the line with us. We'll be talking with him in just a moment, but he's right outside the federal courthouse in West Islip, where he was obviously just involved in a case. But anyway, as he has pointed out, and you must know this, that when people are making claims for benefits after they've been injured, they're in need, and sometimes the help from the law firms is the only source of income and what they get out of the law firm and the dispute, and it's their only source of income and means to access medical treatment. And this law firm will take their case if there is a case to be made, and most of the time there is. The Chase Sinsali Law Group is dedicated to serving the needs of the injured and the disabled, and they were founded back in 2008 with partner Dennis Chase. The firm concentrates its practice in the areas of workers' compensation, Social Security disability, supplemental security income, short and long-term disability, accidental death and dismemberment, unemployment insurance benefits, and employer services. It's a long list of areas that they cover. But as our guest, Joseph Sinsali, points out, his goal is to argue that the claim is viable and compensable. And he says while there is a lot of encouragement to settle cases, they're always ready to go to trial and call witnesses if necessary. It's a very competitive environment, by the way. There are a lot of attorneys who do what this firm does, and they always try and stay a leap ahead. And according to Joe, more money passes through the compensation system in the state of New York than any other court system in the entire state. It's a really big part of their judicial system. And Mr. Sinsali is as passionate about it as ever. He currently serves as the treasurer of the New York Workmen's Compensation Alliance. It's a PAC, that's a political action committee, for the claimant's attorneys to lobby and raise funds regarding issues of workmen's compensation. Those are just some of the things that we're going to be talking about, but it's a real pleasure to have him with us. Again, his name is Joseph Sinsali. He's a co-founder of the Chase Sinsali Law Group in Wantagh, New York. So, Joe, welcome. Nice to have you with us today. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you very much, Doug. I just want to say that the firm is located in Hoppock, New York. I know you. I have a connection with Wantagh, but the firm is located in Hoppock, New York, which is on Long Island. With offices in Nassau County and all throughout the state of New York, actually. So, but the main office is in Hoppock. But I am
that's an important point. We want to make sure we're correct. So Hoppock. Yeah, I love the name of that. Where did that name ever come from? Do you have any idea?
Well, Hoppock. If I do know where it came from, it translates from, I'm not certain which Native American dialect, but it translates to the phrase "land of sweet water." And that's what I believe Hoppock stands for, and you'll see that under the signs that announce the town's name if you come into it. So it's a sweet place to practice and to have headquartered, absolutely.
Well, that's great. That's great. It must be an old Indian name, I guess. It goes way back like that.
But I would imagine, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you're in an area that I know well, and as you point out, there are a lot of firms that do exactly what you do. Do me a favor. Let's just trace your background a little bit before we get so heavily into the law firm and what you're doing. What was it that made you decide you wanted to be a lawyer? How would you answer that?
Okay. I'm asked that question all the time. And the people that would know me, like my wife, April, she would tell me that I'm overly inspired by righteous indignation. So I've always been that way. If I see something that I think is inappropriate, I tend to be extremely vocal about it. And that personality trait, which I guess I've always had, it translates. I mean, how do you manifest that? You manifest it through the practice of law, because again, when I see something that requires judicial intervention, and you want to make sure that judicial intervention occurs so that the proper result is obtained. So to answer that question, I can look back. I have a degree in political theory, so the law is heavily entwined with that. But I would say that if I had to point to a character trait, that would be it.
Well, you know, you're obviously in the right area of the law. You could have gone into any other area of the law, and there are so many, different fields in the arena of law. But I think what you're doing, from what you've said, you're in the right area. Do you love what you're doing? Wanted it to be?
Well, yes. I will tell you this. I did when I graduated law school. I was working for a company, a financial institution company, down in on Wall Street, and I thought I would perhaps continue in that career. But when I got in contact with my partner, Dennis Chase, who was also an alum of St. John's University School of Law, it became very, very clear to me that I love advocacy. I love being in front of a judge, and knowing that if I'm have the proper evidence and the proper position, that I'd like to see that manifest. So, I started out not necessarily doing this, but, life dissolves life, or like attracts life, or however you want to think about it. It brought me into this field, and I've been enjoying it ever since. There are certain things that have occurred in terms of changes in the law and such. It may make the practice a little more intense rather than fun, but you can find the fun no matter what, and you find the opportunity to have fun in protecting the laws that are in place from being radically changed, and making sure that injured workers or disabled individuals are able to access the benefits that they need. So you could always find the silver lining of fun in whatever we're doing, and that's what keeps our practice alive. One of the things, anyway.
Now, are you a trial lawyer?
Yeah, I am. I will practice in front of a judge. I don't. They're not jury trials. They're administrative proceedings, which means that you have a judge, a singular judge who's a finder of fact at the trial level. But the trial is conducted in the same way you see trials on television. You have a witness testify, then that person gets cross-examined. And you have to protect the record by objecting, and then there's other witnesses that come in, and you do the same thing, and you make your opening statement, and then at the conclusion of the testimony and the production of other evidence, you make your closing argument. All the elements that would involve trial advocacy are present in what I do. And as a matter of fact, one thing that goes beyond that is that at the appellate level, we handle all our appellate work for the most part. We would appeal to the review board at the Workers' Compensation Board here in New York, submit briefs, and then if we have to go beyond that, and I've done this very recently, I would argue before the Third Department of the Appellate Division of the State of New York Supreme Court up in Albany, and you would actually proffer all argument in front of a panel of judges at that point to see if they agree or disagree with whatever was found by the Workers' Compensation Board or any administrative agency, for that matter, prior to that.
You know, I should ask you, since you're sitting in your car outside the federal courthouse in West Islip, did you have a trial this morning? Were you in court this morning?
I had hearings this morning. They were not trials. They were Social Security hearings. And those are pretty – they can be intense because you're dealing with – a judge was reviewing evidence and hearing from your client, but it was more of a hearing rather than a trial situation. Hearing means that some testimony is proffered before the judge, evidence is produced, we've submitted our argument earlier, and then the judge just then evaluates the evidence that he hears, either testimonial or through documents, and then makes a decision. So it wasn't a trial per se, as people think about trials, but the same elements of trial advocacy occur here as it would in the Workers' Compensation Board or any other forum for that matter.
Let me ask you, why did you choose to concentrate on workers' compensation? That's a big part of what you deal with. It's a big area. Why focus on that?
That's a great question. And the answer is that there are a couple of different things. The first is that the results are rather relatively quick to obtain. And what I mean by that is that although cases can last years, and we have those, unlike other kinds of law that would take years to develop litigation and such, we usually see the fruits of our labor in a relatively more quickly. So that's one thing that you always want is a personal satisfaction that you've done a job and that job has produced fruit. So that's what the workers' compensation system is designed for, that because, again, it's designed to be the immediate remedy for somebody who is injured on the job and can't provide for their family. So there's got to be a mechanism by which they can institute benefits to them. Now, sometimes cases are accepted, which means that we just have to make sure that the case is maintained in a certain way, or they're controverted, meaning that the insurance company has one of those issues that you identified early on about whether or not the accident could have happened in the course of employment or whether or not the person was even employed by the employer. I mean, we're just touching on the surface of issues. Again, those issues are developed, and it may take a little while, and to the injured worker, it may seem like it's forever, but relatively speaking, in terms of other times of law, the fruits of it are manifest relatively quickly. And then the other thing is that satisfaction that you get from actually seeing the fruits of your labor and what that means. A successful claim may wind up having an injured worker being able to pay their mortgage or not have their car repossessed, put food on the table, you know, that kind of thing. Some injured workers have families, you know, wives and children that they have to provide for. So the workers' compensation system to be a humanitarian type of social legislation does that.
Explain to me what you mean when you say it does that. Let's say some guy has been injured on the job. Maybe he's working on a crane it could be downtown in Manhattan, or it could be out on the island of the building of, you know, some brand new building, and the crane collapses or something happens and he gets really injured. You're right. He has to be hospitalized maybe for a while, and then he's out of work. He's not getting any money during that period of time, and yet he needs the services of a firm like yours. What decision process do you make in whether to accept a case or not?
We're pretty good. My partner and I are pretty good at vetting cases. A lot of things are very clear cut. So, for instance, in your example with the crane, I mean, obviously that's an accident that occurs on the job. So very few issues develop with that. However, you have somebody, for instance, that would come in and say, I have very, very bad carpal tunnel syndrome, and there's no physical injury. You don't see a broken bone or anything like that. But, again, whether or not that person has condition that's related to work, you would ask them at that point, well, what do you do for a living? Well, the individual would say, well, I'm on a keyboard 90% of my day. Well, there you know that you have a case that has the potential to be compensable. So it's all in the vetting process. And with very, very rare exception, would there be a case turned away if we can get the idea that perhaps things are not as forthright as the individual may make it sound, or if it's an older case, if there's nothing that we could do for them because the case has already been adjudicated, we'd let them know that too. So it's all in the vetting process, and between myself and my father, we have about 50 years of experience doing this. You know, you get to know where the cases are and where they were going, what ultimately is going to happen. So, but like I said, in very rare instances, is a case just outrightly found to be something that we wouldn't be able to assist in, but for the most part, it would be. And some people come to us in the middle of the litigation looking for us to help them. Sometimes they've represented themselves, and they get to the point where they realize they can't do that any further, so they'll come in and we'll evaluate that and see if there's anything we can do, not necessarily to salvage, but to bring out the best parts of the case for them, and we would do that. So it's all in the vetting process.
Did these cases that you handled, do they mostly settle or go to trial? What's the average?
That's a good question. And the whole compensation system let me start with Social Security disability. It's not really a trial. Either you get approved or denied, and if you're denied, you're entitled to a hearing. So for a judge will rule about whether or not the denial was proper. So you don't really have trials at that level. You do have trials, though, at the compensation level. And the whole compensation system is designed for amicable resolution. As a matter of fact, even the way the table is laid out, when you go into the courtroom, if you're familiar with, and I know you've done the People's Court, I know if you're familiar, you have the defendant on one side, plaintiff on the other. We qualify people as defendants and claimants. Injured workers are claimants under the law. So they are not in opposition to each other. They face each other at the table in front of the judge. Again, trying to encourage negotiation and resolution amicably. However, there are some issues that can't be resolved amicably. Like, for instance, whether or not an accident actually happened. It really comes down to documentary evidence the testimony of one person over another. So there are issues that do have to be litigated, but the whole goal, the whole point of the compensation system is to negotiate and to try to resolve things without judicial intervention. But sometimes that can't happen. So, again, depending on the issue and the nature of the issue, it can happen at any time during a case. It can happen from the very beginning. It can happen when the person is becoming or being deemed to be permanently disabled, what degree of permanent disability that individual may have, whether or not they're attached to the labor force, if they have a partial disability. There's all these different issues that come up. Again, the compensation system tries to encourage resolution, but there's certain things that certain positions that people would take, whether it be a claimant's attorney or an attorney for a defendant, that may not be amenable to resolution, as you put it that way.
Yeah. I guess you never know what kind of case is going to walk into your door next. I've been reading about some of the kind of cases that you've had. Tell me about the lady who came into you who had a problem when she went to the bathroom. And it was a pretty fascinating case.
Yeah, I can tell you a little bit about that. It's an interesting case. It gives you the idea of the scope of the nature of what we deal with. This poor lady, I got to know her, had actually used the facilities at her job. While doing so, the actual toilet bowl collapsed. So you wonder to yourself, well, what in that? Is that a compensable injury? Was she actually in the course of her employment when something like that happened? She sustained a pretty bad injury to her back as a result. And as a result of litigation and doing some legal research, we were able to have that case found compensable, primarily because it was a benefit to the employer that she go to the bathroom on the employer's premises, amongst other things. Having said that, you know, she couldn't go out to any other bathrooms. The goal was for her to be close to her job. So as a result, it was deemed to be within the course of employment, and that type of injury was compensable and sustainable. A fun one. Proud of that one, but there's other ones I'm proud of as well. But that one just gives you a demonstration of the extent of the type of situation we deal with.
I understand, though, that in order to help win your case, you had to do a lot of research and go all the way back to a lawsuit, a case that was tried in 1942, time ago.
I had to go back.
That was similar.
And as a matter of fact, my counterpart on that case, the adverse party, who I know well, knew that, again, I had access to legal research through the various mechanisms that we have to access cases and such. And this one came up from 1942, which apparently is still good case law. And based on that, it was a similar fact pattern. And then based on that, we were able to win that case. And the opposition kind of conceded the fact that based on that case, that there really was no defense at that point. So, sometimes, it's interesting, and it makes the legal research interesting. You just think about, you're sitting in front of a computer, and you're going through, in the olden days, you used to have to use the old centralization books at the law library, but now everything is mostly electronic. So you would go back and look at certain things, and it's fascinating. It's always been a fascinating aspect of my profession to go back and look and try to match facts up with the facts that may have occurred previously and see what the result was. So, and that's the level that my firm takes it to. You know, we go back and look at cases that are still very good law, but not in the knowledge base of most people. You have to actually go back and look. Sometimes you got to do your homework.
You know, there's another case here this is kind of interesting, especially in your area where people are always running out to get coffee. But the situation was somebody worked for a company and the boss sent one of his employees out to get coffee and bring it back. And the guy was injured in an accident. I think was hit by a car, was crossing the street. Now, does a guy like that get workers' compensation because he wasn't in the building on doing his job? He was running, getting coffee for his boss. How does that happen? What happens in a case like that?
Right. That's a good you bring up a good scenario. The law is actually in flux with that as at this point. But again, it's the same principle. Is he within the course of an employment? Is he fulfilling a obligation that is being mandated by his employer? Is the deviation from employment, because like you said, maybe considered the deviation from employment, is that deviation from employment something that would still rise to fall within the scope of being with work related? So there's different, there's been different cases on that of late. And it used to be that if you were in doing something that would benefit the employer and you're injured in that process, you'd be entitled to compensation. Nowadays, that is not a foregone conclusion. So, I mean, there's different things, and that's what makes this practice so really exciting. If you don't know, you know, you'd like to put your best foot forward and make the arguments that you need to make. But again, the law is in flux on certain things in workers' compensation, and that's one of them. So you don't know what's going to happen. And then, you know, you can make the argument to the appeal board if you're unsuccessful, or you have to defend your argument if you are successful. So to answer your question, that's something that, and again, the approach is, you know, what are the facts? What are, was there a very, very clear direction for this individual to go do that kind of thing? That all tends to make a yay or nay about whether or not it's compensable or not. And then again, it depends on how the judge's view and what the current state of the law is, which is, like I said, that particular area, that or that particular set of circumstances, that's in flux.
You know, I guess I should ask the question. People may be wondering who hear this. Are you the kind of law firm that works on a contingency basis? You take the case?
Yes.
You know what I mean, and others know what I mean. How do you answer that?
Well, what happens is by law, we cannot charge any fees on the workers' compensation end of it. What happens is that if we're successful, all the fees are adjudicated by a judge. We can put in a request, but the judge will adjudicate what the fee is, and then that would come out of the benefit that would go to the injured worker. So it would come out of retroactive benefits, meaning that if they haven't been paid any compensation and we go to court and we're successful, the fee could be awarded out of that. Just an example. Aside from other circumstances where we could charge for expenses like for travel on a Social Security case, when it comes to workers' compensation, that's pretty much fixed as an award from the judge based on the efforts of the attorney and the money that out of the money that is awarded to the claimant or to the injured worker.
Well, the main point there is if somebody is injured and if they don't have any money, it doesn't mean they don't have a source to go to get help. They could come to you, and the fact that they don't have a big bankroll to pay for a lawyer, it doesn't mean they can't get help. They can get help from you.
That
right?
is correct.
If you accept their case.
We do not charge a retainer up front. If that's the law specifically prohibits that. So
a lot of people worry about that, you know, in cases like that you deal with. Let me ask you something that's kind of interesting. You're the treasurer of the New York Workmen's Compensation Alliance. And I pointed out earlier, this is from information from you, that more money passes through the compensation system in the state of New York than any other court system in the whole state. That's a lot of money feeding through that area of trust.
It is. It's a lot of money because awards can be made on a daily basis. Like I said, the workers' compensation, things tend to manifest a little more quickly than they do with other kinds of law. So you get to see more of a flow of finance. Presuming there are no issues, you see a flow of the financial flow coming out of the court system. Now, whether or not that's true more today than it was, say, a few years ago, there's been some changes in the laws and the regulations in the workers' compensation system in New York that are making it increasingly difficult for people to make the claims that they want, that they have evidentiary support to make, but not see the monetary benefit that comes with that. So, that also is in flux. But yeah, it's an important system because again, something that's the remedy. It's what we call an exclusive remedy. So if somebody gets hurt on the job, they can't say knock on the employer's door and say, I'm serving you with papers, I'm suing you in civil court. It doesn't work that way under most circumstances. But for the most part, the exclusive remedy is workers' compensation. So in other words, you make a claim against your employer or your employer's insurance company for the benefit that you're seeking. So and that, like I said, that can go on a daily basis. So.
Well, you know, the whole key to this, and we have a minute or so left, is the fact that you decided to go into law as a young man, and now you're in the midst of it. You're in the midst of your career. You're practicing this form of law. How do you like it? Do you love what you're doing?
I do. I do like it for the most part. I mean, like any type of work, they say if you love your work, you never work a day in your life. I won't go as far as saying that work is work, but it's an integral part of life. But I will tell you that I've had situations where, like my father, facilitated the documentation and paperwork necessary to secure benefits for an individual that was didn't have much. He had such a debilitating condition that he didn't have long to live. So the goal was to try to obtain benefits and secure benefits for his family before his demise. And we were able to do that on no other day of the year other than Christmas Eve. We were able to do that, and it allowed the individual who passed on not too much longer after that, but his family to receive the benefit that they would have been, that we not have been entitled to receive, would not have been entitled to receive otherwise. So that part of it makes it enjoyable to see that. It's a heartwarming, it warms the cockles of our hearts to see something like that. And that's why you get to see the fruit of your labor. I have a friend of mine that often says to me, I'm so glad that you're in the law that you're in, rather than being in some other kind of, not to disparage the legal profession, because I won't. I like to try my hand at anything. But at the same time, he's very happy that I'm using my skills for situations just like that. So,
I'm glad of that.
Yeah,
obviously. You're in the right job. Listen, thank you for taking the time to talk with us. It's we've gone through the half hour just like that. Our guest has been Joseph Sinsally. He's the co-founder of the Chase Sinsally Law Group. They're headquartered in Hop Hog on New York's Long Island. And their website, by the way, is chasesinsally.com. And Sinsally is spelled S-E-N-S-A-L-E, chasesinsally.com. Hey, Joe, thanks for your time. I really love chatting with you. Thank you very much and continued good fortune, okay?
Thank you very much, Doug, and it's been a pleasure and an honor. Thank you so much.
You're very, very welcome indeed. That's it, everybody. The great story of the Chase Sinsally Law Group on Long Island.
You've been listening to CUTV News Radio. If you want to learn more about our programming or perhaps be considered for a future show, visit us on the web at www.cutvnews.com. And if you enjoyed listening to today's show, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher, and be sure to write a review. Thanks for listening, and from all of us at CUTV News Radio, we hope you have a productive and inspired day.
That's it for today, everybody. I'm Doug Llewellyn. Take care. Have a great day. And bye for now.